Welcome to Tilt Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking about micronutrient testing and CEC with row crops. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at the Monarch MKV dairy tractor with autonomous feed pushing. Ag History Minute, we'll talk about Victor Ernest Shelford. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilties out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. Yay, we got winter-ish.
I mean, cold.
We got snow again, cold and snow.
Cold snow.
At least we got the snow part this time. We've had the cold and intermittently had snow, so we'll see how long it lasts. But at least for the time being, it's cold enough to keep it from all melting away.
Bill, have you gotten a bunch of questions about alfalfa?
Just one. Yeah. When it was really, you know, a handful of weeks ago, late January there when it was really cold. Yeah, couple questions about, you know, should I add some more seed to my order just in case? It was more of a further north farm that normally they see, like even south of 29 where we maybe don't have the snowpack all summer, where they usually do keep the snowpack.
Snow, sure.
And he's just like, yeah. I'm like, yeah, you may want to add a few, but he's got relatively young stands, so I think that's going to help a lot.
Usually, too, we've talked about this before, winter kill usually happens late winter, early spring, right. More than, you know, obviously there's some daggers thrown and maybe some scars, but it's not dead yet usually.
That it's early. The ice, the wet.
Or
the,
we just don't know. Right, yeah. Right.
And we're not wet.
No.
Yeah. I've had a couple of questions about wheat, too, as far as, you know, what yeah. the wheat can look like, because that, you know, the dry fall.
Right, some of that looked pretty iffy going right. into the fall, so I would agree that.
So I would say that's more of a concern in my head than.
But having this snow cover now, that insulation factor over it, it's always good. So especially if we can hold it kind of through February and most of March, that usually helps a lot.
Still need a lot more for those snowmobilers, though.
Oh yeah, well I'm sure there's somebody that tried a snowmobile at this point.
Well, there's people, yeah. Oh, but it's. Usually need that one big old storm to kind of get her going. And
I don't know. If you live south of 29 and you own a snowmobile, you better own a trailer for it if you really want to get use out of it. It's the way I've always looked at it, because I can count on one hand the good snowmobiling years I can remember around here, especially in the last few years.
It's been a long time.
It's hard because it's so hit or miss. Like we've had... And there, when it does, when the trails do open, in like you say, the counties south of Highway 29, usually it's for like a week or 10 days. It's not like.
Right. If you get 2 weeks, or, that's like a good pull.
2 weeks is great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. You guys ready to get into our topic for today?
Yeah.
It's a deep one.
Bill's didn't sound very. He's just like, yeah,
Bill. Bill is.
Yeah, he didn't say the let's do this.
Right.
He's just kind of like, eh.
Still trying to wrap his head around what we're going to talk about.
No, Matt did explain it to us, Bill.
And I'm in the dark.
This is very. It's
so this stemmed from a talk we saw at a conference a couple weeks ago, and it was talking about how, you know, accuracy of soil testing when it comes to micronutrients. And the more I read into it, it seems like CEC is a factor in there, too, of, you know, should you just be using the same routine extraction stuff? So I'm going to try not to get too deep into that side of it, but just kind of give you an idea of what the difference is. And so you've got the Malic 3, which is not really even what we do for everything in Wisconsin, because we're still using Bray for certain things.
We're weird.
We're special. But a lot of the states in around us and throughout the Corn Belt and everything else use Malic 3. And so that one's good for macronutrients, the big ones, you know, phosphorus, potassium. But
I do hate going to conferences and we talk to these labs or
they're always like Malic, or like this
the GPS software, the JS software we're looking at, and how do you bring your soil, you know, soil tests? And it just, it's like, oh, you guys are from Wisconsin. It's almost like we're sorry for you.
Yeah. And we're not the only ones. There are a couple other ones that do use different things. It can vary a little bit by state. But
in general, Malek is the kind of.
And the reason, when you read into it, is because it combines the efficiencies of Bray, which is what I mentioned, and Olson testing to one test to use for multiple nutrients. So that's why everybody else kind of uses it. Is it? I don't know why. I don't remember ever hearing the exact reason why we don't believe in Malek in Wisconsin.
The Swiss Army knife of soil testing?
I don't think it's a perfect Swiss Army knife, but it, I mean, it's it seems like it would make sense, but whatever. Anyway, so for regular soil testing, that one's, like I said, considered kind of the standard for a lot of places. But for micros, it can vary, especially when you get into issues with pH. So if you're talking about micronutrients in particular, so calcium, magnesium, zinc, iron, manganese, all those fun ones, we... If you want more information on micronutrients, you can go back 100 or so, well, almost 150 episodes to when we did our series on micronutrients that we talked about specific ones.
Was that long ago?
118, really? I think, was the first. Wow. Like, it was like micronutrients 101. So
we might have to bring them back. Those were...
Is that COVID?
Those were good. No, it was right after.
No, that would have been after.
COVID.
But yeah, we did, I think... 5 or 6 episode arc there on all the micronutrients. So I think it's 118 to like 124 or 25. So if you're interested in finding out in extreme detail about micronutrients, we get you covered. But yeah, so doing anything with micronutrients and cation exchange capacity or CEC. So the amounts of calcium magnesium extracted with Malek 3 is similar to what's found with ammonium acetate, which is another test. Amount of calcium magnesium does not seem the same when soils have higher pHs. So that's where we run into the issue. So it says basically, and this is according to Iowa State, so this was from a study Iowa State had done, that they do not recommend Malek 3 for use in measuring calcium, magnesium, or CEC in calcareous or high pH soils, or for any micronutrients in any soil, to the problem being that it can be variable. It doesn't always come back exactly how you want. So they said in their study that they just can't recommend it. So current interpretations for zinc in Iowa were used as of the time of the study was the DTPA test, and that's what we're going to talk about next. That's the another type of test you can use on micronutrients. So
that's is DTPA newer, Matt? It's fairly new to probably our listeners. It's new to me, and I want you to try to say the whole acid that DTP
yes,
is.
Yes, I will try to.
I will be impressed if you can do this.
So it's actually been around for a while. So the one study I found talked about soil test stuff from the Czech Republic.
Nice.
Where they use Malek 3 for macronutrients and DTPA and hot water extraction for micros. And so they try to find the date on some of this stuff because they talk about they've been doing soil testing there since like the 60s.
Yeah, from what I found, it said that was developed in 1978.
Yeah, there we go.
By Lindsay and Norvell to identify near neutral and calcareous soils with insufficient micronutrients.
Yeah, so it's... In the looking at the span of agricultural history, it is relatively new, being from the 70s, but it's not new. It's, you know, expands beyond Todd and my lifetime. Bill, I don't remember exactly what year
it's
you were
good
born.
Year.
Was the year you were born?
Yep.
There you go. So it's a test as old as Bill.
It's old.
Yeah, you're right.
And Bill was born in January, so I mean, it's a good chance he was alive when this was fully developed. But anyway, yeah. So DTPA stands for diethylene triamine pentaacetic acid.
That's pretty good.
And that is used as a better test for micronutrients and not limited by pH like Maalic 3 is. So DTPA was selected as the chelating agent because it can effectively extract all four micronutrient metals. Factors such as pH, concentration of the chelating agent, time of shaking, and temperature of extraction affect the amount of micronutrients extracted and can be adjusted for maximum overall effectiveness. So you have these two different ways of doing it, and depending on the lab you use, you may be getting a different result based on the type of test that's used. So is that a huge deal? Is it groundbreaking? Is it going to kill us? Are we doing it wrong? And so I found a couple studies, one in particular from Kansas State, and this other one I've been talking about with Iowa State, looking at the two in comparison. So here in Wisconsin, we have a set of sufficiency ranges for micronutrients. You can find that in some UW publications that kind of tell the story. Most of the labs here, I don't know if any of the labs are using DTPA. Have you guys heard of any of them using it? Most of them are using a different extraction.
Right. No. Not that.
I know the Dakotas, the speaker we saw a couple weeks ago is from the Dakotas, so there are labs to the west of us that are using the DTPA method. So presumably other ones are using either Maalic 3 or this DTPA, other states. So when you look at, I've got a couple charts here that for you guys, Todd and Bill, to look at, where it compares DTPA to Maalic 3. And there are some differences. I mean, it's not super comparable. In some cases, others, it's fairly close to me, within 0.05. Seems pretty close to me versus, you know, some that are 8 to 10 points apart. So obviously there is a difference there. So when they looked across all the different categories for copper, zinc, manganese, iron, and boron in particular, so boron, they're actually using a hot water extraction as opposed to the DTPA because apparently that works really well for boron. You just have to...
That's crazy.
One thing I did read...
Chuck out water.
You have to make sure there's no boron in the water. So you use distilled water and make sure it has no existing boron. Otherwise, that screws up the test.
Makes double boron.
Yeah. So yeah, the big, you know, the differences here, like I said, they go from very little to, you know, four to 8 points-ish, somewhere in there. And then, so they kind of came up with the differences in the two as far as, like, if you use a different sufficiency range for each one. And again, these are not huge differences. Like, so light soils with boron, low is 0.55 milligrams per kilogram because it's in metric naturally. Didn't have time to convert it to see what that would be. But in light soil, and that's with Maalic 3, when you go to DTPA, it's 0.4. So different, but not hugely different. Copper, it's, yeah, less than 1.6, less than 0.8. Zinc, less than 2.2, less than 1. So it changes, and the explanation for it is basically that Maalic 3, in some cases, will extract higher amounts of the micronutrients, and that's why you see the difference in ranges. So Kansas State, they concluded relationships between Maalic 3 and DTPA extractable micronutrients metals were investigated in soils from Kansas. Maalic 3 and DTPA micronutrients were positively correlated between the two methods. However, Maalic 3 extracted more in some soils with a high pH. When they looked at it, it's not like a one-to-one, so you can't say, oh, if it's this in Maalic, it's this at DTPA, so they're not comparable directly that way, but can be influenced by soil pH, as we said. So results from the study show that conversion of Maalic 3 to extractable to a DTPA equivalent is possible, but you have to take into account soil pH to improve the accuracy, especially when it comes to iron and manganese. So is it something you necessarily have to worry about? Not really. As long as you're using, you're being consistent in how you look at it, it doesn't seem like it's going to be a big problem. And there's other ways to measure micronutrients. You know, obviously, if you're seeing deficiencies, you know, we know what deficiency symptoms look like in corn, soybeans, all that with micronutrients. We would do other types of testing, tissue test, all that other kind of stuff. So I thought this was going to be like this huge deal after hearing, you know, that there was this different method, like, you know, are we doing it wrong? And there is a difference, and it's important to know the difference. Like I said, being consistent, so don't, you know, send it to one lab that's using DTPA and then compare it to a different lab using Malic 3. But in the end of the, at the end of the day, it's as long as you're, like I said, being consistent, it's probably not going to be that big of a deal.
And we're dealing with very small amounts of soil test levels anyway.
Right.
You know, so it's not like we're in high parts per million like we are in P and K or any of those micros, or it's a very small amount. So at some point it could, you know, potentially if you get, like you said, Matt, if you're bumping back and forth between the two tests, you could potentially have an issue because you're not being consistent. And we've always said, whenever we soil test, be consistent, right? Whether that's depth, time of year, lab, all those kinds of things. It's good to see that these two different tests aren't that far off. So it isn't, like you said, Matt, like the end of the world, but at the same point,
yeah, it's enough to know there's a difference.
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're really concerned about your micronutrients and you want to be more exact, you're probably better off using DTPA, especially if you have higher pH soils. But if you're in general just, you know, trying to make sure that you have enough of a micronutrient, it probably doesn't matter which method you use.
That's helpful, Matt, because there's times where we're not soil scientists by any means, especially not lab experts, and you can get in the weeds on this so far. And these lab guys, to them, this is their whole world and a big deal. And, you know, oh my God, we should be using this one or this one. And at sometimes for us, as we're, you know, trying to learn from these soil tests, that gets really difficult. So just knowing, like, okay, just know that when, can you maybe define high pH? Like, is it, what were they using for the study?
7.3 was kind of the line. So 7.3 and below is fine. Once you get to 7.4 and above, that's where you're going to see a difference.
Which we run into soils that are that high in pH.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
So we'll have to take that into account or consideration. But like you say you're under 7.4, you're probably fine. You know, it's not as kind of a critical thing. So that is tricky because, yeah, when you read those soil tests then and you get to that, it's almost like they need an asterisk by that number that, you know, says, like, yeah, this may or may not be, you know, maybe over exaggerating how much the plant can get.
Well, I think the bigger deal here too is if you're finding yourself using more micronutrient packs and applying micronutrients without really even checking existing levels, you could be building up like certain ones, like we talked about boron and boron toxicity, like there's a potential you could be causing a problem the other way. So it's important to manage your micronutrients. It's just, you know, looking at this, it's not necessarily that big of a deal which way you look at it as long as you're consistent. And like I said, the way you can look at deficiency symptoms and other or toxicity symptoms in some cases will kind of help you guide what you should be doing in the field as it is. So yeah, that'll do it for the main topic. Now let's move into our spotlight for today. So Monarch makes the MKV dairy tractor with autonomous feed pushing. So it's auto drive technology is the first commercially available fully autonomous feature in a driver optional tractor. So it is available as EV or diesel. Autonomous feed pushing offers value to dairy farmers by improving efficiency and increasing milk production. According to Praveen Penmetsa, CEO and co-founder of Monarch Tractor, it allows dairy farmers to focus on what matters most, the health and well-being of their animals. Autonomous feed pushing helps dairy farmers manage through labor shortages and the ability to monitor feed pushing remotely while tending to other critical tasks ensures cows can be consistently fed every hour. So additionally, the smart tractor is armed with Monarch's Wingspan Ag Intelligence and Wingspan AI technology stack, which tracks performance data while 360-degree camera allows you to record footage for real-time and historical insights. The MKV Dairy is also a mobile power bank with 12-volt, 110-volt, and 220-volt plugs. So Monarch is hosting an in-person auto drive demonstration at a working dairy on February 12th, 3 p.m. in Tulare, California, during the World Ag Expo. So if you're headed out there, you might be able to check one of these out. If you can't make it to California, Monarch says dairy farmers can reach out and set up a demonstration on their farm. So it's a whole new level. Like, we've seen the little robots that push feed, but this is like next level of ability with a, I mean, it's not a huge looking tractor, but still a tractor.
Almost looks like a UTV or a Kubota type, but you can drive it.
Right. All right. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. So today we're going to talk Victor Ernest Shelford. And Victor Shelford has been called the father of American animal ecology because of he was one of the first scientists to study natural environments as communities of complex relationships among animals and plants. Beginning at Indiana Dunes, his research led to what became known as Shelford's Law of Tolerance, which states that every species is able to successfully live and reproduce only within a defined range of environmental conditions, including temperature, sunlight, soil type, and moisture. His law of tolerance points out the second limitation of Liebig's law of the minimum, that factors act in concert rather than in isolation. So a low level of one factor can sometimes be partially compensated for by appropriate levels of other factors. He also defined the concept of a biome. These fundamental principles of physiological ecology are still taught in introductory ecology classes today. Shelford's contributions include both his indefatigable research and his inspiration to students. So I know we talked about Liebig's Law of the Minimum before, and I thought it was interesting that it's kind of a shows a contradiction to it in some ways of that it's not only the level of a particular nutrient that can affect it, but they work in concert. So having too many that are too low is probably worse. But some can compensate for others. And then I had to look up what the primary limitation of Liebig's Law of the Minimum was.
Oh, yeah, because this said it's the second.
Right. And that is neglecting the potential for multiple nutrients or environmental factors to simultaneously restrict growth. So, again, the cumulative effect of multiple things being wrong versus, you know, having one limiting factor. So it doesn't account for complex interactions between limiting factors.
Yeah, that makes sense. When they talk about the barrel stave thing, they just make it look like the rest of the staves are fine, and then you just got this one low one,
right.
And like that's not at all real world is what you're saying, Matt.
Right. Even if you patch that leak, it could be then you're going to find another leak because, well, you patched that one, and you thought it was fine, but then turns out there's something else wrong. I think auto mechanics probably yeah. know this the best because you can't. They'll diagnose one problem, fix it, and then another problem crops right. up because it was secondary to that one. So,
all right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to our listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's very easy; just search Tilth Talk Radio on your iPhone in Apple Podcasts, or on an Android phone, download an app like Podcast Addict. You can also listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthag.com/podcasts And you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilth Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll move into our Cool Beans, That's Corny, and some current events. So Cool Beans?
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. More than 2,000 dairy products have been entered into a contest. So the more than 2,400 entries have been received for this year's United States Championship Cheese Contest. The U.S. Championships are hosted in odd number years. The World Championships are in even number years by the Wisconsin Cheesemakers Association.
Yeah, I thought we were just talking about this, but that would make sense that
we were talking
about the world.
The World Championships, yep, this is just the U.S., so the best of the best dairy products will be judged next month in Green Bay, Wisconsin. So it's local. Ooh. As judges evaluate cheese, butter, cultured products, and dry dairy ingredients across 117 classes. Gold, silver, and bronze medals will be awarded to the three highest scoring entries in each category. Judges will evaluate each product and calculate a precise score based on attributes including flavor, body, texture, salt, color, finish, and packaging. Dairy product manufacturers are very competitive, and for good reason. Placing in the top three helps build brands and attract new markets and top dollar for their products. So that's kind of a cool thing coming up.
Can you go to this? It says they're judging March 4th through the 6th at the Resch Center in Green Bay.
Wow. Like,
can you?
They're trying to capitalize on the draft.
They're going to be before the draft, right?
Draft right there.
Like it doesn't say much about
tickets. Like, buy your tickets.
Like I just feel like there'd be a whole bunch of like leftover cheese too. Like, like you know, they're going to sample X amount.
It's actually what all the workers of the Resch eat for the next month.
Yeah,
is all leftover cheese.
Be leftover for the draft. Yeah, do you think they like the judges too? You pop a couple of cheese and then you got to eat some prunes with it to. Or like the week after has got to be pretty rough. If
probably if just you're, spit it out.
Yeah, you want. Yeah, they probably do. You're right.
Probably
they
just chew and it spit. And spit. Unless it's a liquid dairy product, just
yeah, like yogurt. Yeah.
Do you think? Do you think like when the winners are like at a dog show or a cattle show where the winners are and then everyone claps for the winner? Or do you think it just
even like the dry products like dry milk? Do you rehydrate it and drink it?
I think you should try to go,
the flavor,
man.
Or do you? Is it like cocaine? You just sniff it.
I think you should try to go.
Should we do a live podcast? Yeah, we should see if we get in. Yeah,
we could like play by play.
Get press credentials. We can call the U.S. championship.
I mean, the draft at one point was pretty small and boring. Now it's
a big deal.
Big deal. Maybe we could make the
it's
U.S.
gonna shut down Green Bay about a month after the U.S. cheese championships.
Matt, you got to go to this. So the winners are announced April 17th at CheeseCon.
CheeseCon?
CheeseCon. So CheeseCon is held at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison, Wisconsin. So that's from April 15th to the 17th.
I only care about the squeaky curd contest.
Yeah.
I would like to be.
But like, why? That's odd, too, that they judge like a month and a half before the awards are announced. Like later at CheeseCon, that's kind of interesting too.
Well, that many entries,
right?
They got to tally
yeah, maybe
up the scores.
It just takes
a while.
Takes too long, yeah.
And maybe there's a category of like, how do you feel 3 days after you eat
right,
cheese?
You're right.
Or another dairy product.
They gotta
like how did it process in your system? Yeah. Might be more to this than we know.
Too much,
but anyway,
too far, Matt.
That's corny this week. Ag traders and manufacturers have seen their report looks tough when it comes to profit outlooks. So Reuters' Carl Plum reported on last Tuesday that grains merchant Archer Daniels Midland posted its lowest fourth quarter adjusted profit in 6 years based on weak oilseed crush margins and uncertainty over U.S. biofuel policy. And it says it is cutting costs and slashing up to 700 jobs to weather the market downturn. Chicago-based ADM said it aimed to cut costs by $500 million to $700 million over the next 3 to 5 years via job cuts and lower raw material and manufacturing costs, and lower those costs. Reuters also reported last week that grain traders would soon start laying off employees in global effort to cut costs, with the bulk of cuts expected in the U.S., according to sources. ADM did not provide details about the cuts, which would represent roughly 1.7% of its global workforce. So, sounds like fun, right?
No, that's corny.
It is corny. So, unfortunately, that's the way things are looking right now, but you never know when things can turn around. So, hopefully, we'll see some differences in the next quarter. All right. And now we will wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. This week, we're going to meet Wisconsin's 2025 Outstanding Young Farmer. Name is Lindsay Bannock, and she didn't know she wanted to be a full-time farmer until her senior year in college, when her parents asked her to join Maple Mound Farms, their successful cash crop, beef, and produce business near Helenville, Wisconsin. She agreed and joined the business 10 years ago. Now she and her husband, Eric, own 80 acres of their own land, using her parents' equipment to manage it. Eric has his own business, but helps with the farm repair and work and other tasks. Lindsay became the full-time manager of Jelly's Market, quickly assuming full management duties. Then in 2022, at the beginning of apple harvest season, the farm's orchard manager passed away from a heart attack, so Lindsay assumed orchard management responsibilities a lot earlier than she planned. So Jelly's Market began as a fruit and produce farm to support the family's cash crop and beef farm. Eventually grew to include a farm store selling meat and produce, and the family partnered with its neighbors to raise apples. Through the years, the farm has added new crops and expanded the store. They plant the Ever Crisp variety, a late-season apple with exceptional flavor and storage properties. In 2016, the farm built a commercial kitchen to market produce in different ways. They created a one-stop fresh farm shopping experience, selling fresh produce, meat, pork, chicken, honey, and other local items. And as a result, the business increased its customer base by almost 200% since 2001. The farm also implemented a drip irrigation system for its raspberry, blueberry, and apple crops. Drip irrigation allows for timelier and more efficient watering. Plus, water does not touch the leaves of the fruit, decreasing the risk of disease. Maple Mound's Farms utilizes alfalfa hay and winter wheat crops for soil conservation. Alfalfa is grown on any part or any field or part of a field that contains highly erodible land. Farm participates in farmland preservation and instituted a soil and water conservation plan. In addition, conservation tillage is used only when necessary. Fields with crops harvested in early fall, such as soybeans or corn silage, are planted with winter wheat. Jelly's Market also provides ag promotion opportunities to the non-farming community. Plus, every summer and fall, the farm hosts tours for hundreds of students. So, they are also, Lindsay's a member of the Jefferson County Farm Bureau. She's a certified 4-H leader and has been the county youth meats judging coach since 2014. She's a founding member of the Jefferson County Fair Advisory Board, member of the Wisconsin Berry Growers Association, and served a one-year term on the Jefferson School District Community Referendum Committee and on the board of the UW-River Falls College of Agriculture alumni from 2016 to 2019. So there you go.
There's a lot going on there.
There's a lot going on there. Very diverse farm that they are running.
It shows up on Google Maps.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's pretty cool. They've got some orchards and vineyards and... pretty neat.
All right. Well, that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about micronutrient and CEC testing for row crops, whether it's Malic 3 or DTPA. As long as you're consistent, you're probably getting good results. In our spotlight, we took a look at the Monarch MKV dairy tractor with autonomous feed pushing. Ag History Minute, we talked about Victor Ernest Shelford and Shelford's Law of Tolerance. Cool Beans this week was more than 2,000 dairy products entered into the U.S. cheese contest. That's corny. Manufacturers and ag traders report a tough profit outlook from last quarter. And Field Good Friday was the 2025 Outstanding Young Farmer, Lindsay Bannock. So thanks for listening. As always, happy farming.